In Juneau, I'm Chloe Pleznak. As plastic waste piles up across the planet, powerful currents in the ocean and the atmosphere push it toward the Arctic. In a new report out this week, a group of scientists and Alaska Native leaders say those plastics contaminate resources that are essential to Indigenous communities where human-caused climate change is already threatening health and food sources. The report comes ahead of negotiations for an international plastics treaty that's happening later this month. KTOO's Anna Canny reports.
Vi Wagai grew up in the village of Savanga on St. Lawrence Island, where meat from walrus, seal, and bowhead whale sustained her family through the long winters.
My people continue to live off the land and ocean like we have for millennia. Our elders call the Bering Sea our farm.
Today, as an elder herself, Wagai wants her grandson to have the same traditional foods, but food security in the Arctic is increasingly threatened. The burning of fossil fuels is heating the region four times faster than anywhere else on the planet. Warming waters are disrupting the food chain, melting sea ice is erasing animal habitat, and making hunting more dangerous.
And we are some of the most highly contaminated population on the planet because of our reliance on our subsistence foods.
Plastics contain toxins that have been linked to long-term health problems like cancer, hormone disruption, and damage to the heart, liver, and kidneys. And pollution from plastics and other chemicals has made its way to the Arctic, causing health problems for Alaska Native communities that live there. That's according to a new report from Alaska Community Action on Toxics and the International Pollutants Elimination Network. The scientists and Alaska Native leaders who put the report together are calling for an end to new plastic production worldwide. Some of those authors, including scientist Pamela Miller, will represent Alaska's Arctic communities at a meeting of the United Nations later this month.
We now know that there are microplastics in fish and walrus, bearded seal, ringed seal, spotted seal.
Miller says strong currents in the ocean and the atmosphere naturally move from lower latitudes to the poles, carrying plastic and other pollutants along with them.
And we also know that with climate warming happening so rapidly that the highest concentrations of microplastics are found in those areas where there's the most rapid melting of sea ice.
The melting of sea ice, permafrost, and glaciers also releases plastics and chemicals that have long been bound in ice. In 2022, the United Nations set out to write a treaty on how to deal with the growing plastic waste. They've held several meetings to hash out the terms, including one coming up later this month in Ottawa, Canada, where the authors of the new report will join representatives from more than 100 other countries. Miller says there's only one real solution to the plastic problem.
First thing is to curb the production of chemicals and plastics. Since they're reliant on fossil fuel production, that also means curbing fossil fuel production.
But not everyone agrees with her. Most plastic is created with chemicals derived from fossil fuels. And as demand for oil and gas in transportation or home heating drops with the switch to cleaner energy, many in the fossil fuel industry see plastics as a way to support their future business. At the treaty meeting last fall, representatives from oil and gas producing companies and countries pushed for recycling and cleanup solutions instead, despite years of research that suggests only a tiny fraction of recycled plastic is actually transformed into new items. Wagai said she hopes that Arctic Indigenous communities are able to push back against those industry interests.
Our people have done all we could to make sure our lands, areas, and waters are protected. And then these multinational corporations do not take human health into account.
She said she's headed to Ottawa to protect the health and food of her grandson. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
On Garden Talk, I spoke with Khalil English about his research on silverweed, a seemingly inconspicuous plant with deep roots in Pacific Northwest history. English spoke about silverweed's importance as a food source across the North and where you can find it in Juneau.
So silverweed first came into my life, I believe, through a book that I got from Professor Daniel Monteith. Gave me a book called Ha Chai Ha Kastiiksiti. It means our food ways is our Tlingit way of life. And there are some plant foods in there that I had never heard of before. And one of them was tsait or silverweed. And that kind of just grew into something huge. I looked into some of the Tlingit uses and how it's harvested here. and then found, oh my gosh, it's a beloved plant all throughout the Pacific Northwest, and even it's has circumboreal, it's all around the north, and even in Europe and Scotland and Norway, etc., people have loved silverweed. So it ended up becoming a little bit of a self-history search as well. A lot of the information that I have been able to learn comes from the Kwakwaka'wakw, which are just the northern tip of Vancouver Island and a little bit on the mainland. And that's sort of where the temperate rainforest is just like nonstop summer and winter rain. And so we have these huge estuarine river systems, and people would bioengineer the salt marsh. So according to sources from the Kwakwaka'wakw, there were not a single patch of salt marsh that wasn't owned and tended by someone. So it was a very intensively managed crop. There was a lot of food that people got from it. It was a very important ceremonially. There was actually a taboo, at least in this area, for not eating the silverweed until I think it was at least like around December, which has a little bit to deal with getting the roots to taste sweeter. And then as far as Scotland, there's sadly not as much information, but there is still a lot of love in some of the few stories I could find. There's a little a Gaelic phrase that I learned that I'll share that kind of highlights some of the feelings around it. And it's Briskin Bianachta an Yerich Shechgov Aranayel. It means blessed silverweed of spring, seventh bread of the Gaels. And so along with like millet and rye and wheat, silverweed was very important. And so people, when they were given their allotments for fishing and et cetera, silverweed patches were a part of that, at least in Scotland. And then when the potato famine happened, people actually returned to eating silverweed.
Where can people in Juneau typically find silverweed and respectfully harvest it as well?
Yeah, so silverweed is abundant. There's actually quite a few subspecies of silverweed. So Pacific silverweed is sort of what I've mostly been focusing on. They have the biggest roots, and they're going to be mostly along the ocean side. But even for folks in interior Alaska, or I don't know, in Utah, there is still silverweed. It prefers more salty grounds. So for us, you know, that's right on the ocean side, could be at the edge of some lake, down further south. Places, more direct places in Juneau might be Fish Creek. The Mendenhall Wetlands would be the most ideal spot, but of course, I don't know how safe it is to eat anything out of there, given the airport and the waste management system. But pretty much anywhere where you're gonna, like Sandy Beach, all the edges are covered in silverweed. Any beach, right under that beach rye, that really like grayish blue grass that's very thick, silverweed is right there.
And what time of year is the best time to keep an eye out for this? You were saying that culturally there's a little bit of connection to different times of the year for harvesting that, perhaps.
Yeah, so for our area, what I've read is mostly people would harvest in the spring. And then what I've read for down in Vancouver, people mostly harvest it in the fall, but I think it's a little interchangeable. What they're going for is once the plant starts growing actively, once you can see anything above ground, the roots are very, very astringent. They become really bitter. There's a lot of tannins. And so when you harvest either the very beginning of spring, those tannins have waned out, or in the fall, those tannins are reduced a lot. And then when you dry them and store them cold, the tannin content is further reduced. So wintertime, you got to kind of familiarize yourself with habitat, and then you can go and look for their dried leaves. They persist pretty well and are easy to recognize. And then you dig in. One last thing I'll share, and this was a little more of my focus, is something I've loved about silverweed is it really highlights the relationship that people can and have for many thousands of years had with the earth. I think too often when we're talking about environmental topics, it becomes really depressing and we kind of demonize ourselves. But to me, this really highlights like, oh, we have a place. We also are tending the earth as well. And by tending these wild systems, they can become more productive. We can take advantage of it, and so can the rest of the wildlife. But in today's world, of course, it's a little harder to go out and say, start bioengineering our salt marsh here so people can bring them into their gardens. They're very adaptable.
That was Khalil English speaking with me last week about his research on silverweed. You can find a link to that research on our website, ktoo.org. This sunshine is sticking around until at least Saturday, with highs in the mid-50s and clear skies at night, with lows around 38. In Juneau, I'm Chloe Plesnack. You're listening to All Things Considered.